nicked, falling down, but there's a lot of salvage here.
The most rewarding part of what we do, for me, is doing an entire house by hand, disassembling an entire house by hand, and salvaging all this beautiful, beautiful material. You know, a house that was built 1910, 1920. It's making way for some new construction, but we can get in there and take it down by hand, denail all the material and get it out there into the marketplace and get it reused. That's very, very rewarding.
KABU reporter Don Wolf spoke with Dr. Marcus Erickson, who's currently working to document and study the giant floating sheen of plastic garbage in the Pacific Ocean.
I'm the Director of Education and Research for the Algalita Marine Research Foundation. And for 10 years, we've traveled from Hawaii back to Los Angeles and L.A. to Hawaii, surveying the amount of plastic trash that's accumulating in the North Pacific Ocean. Now, the North Pacific Ocean is like a giant toilet bowl, twice the size of the United States, that never flushes. And plastic trash that leaves the Pacific Rim, countries like Japan, China, United States, Canada, Mexico, all the plastic trash is building up in the North Pacific at an alarming rate.
And it is actually building up near the United States, closer than any of the other countries you mentioned. Is that correct?
Our study area is roughly 1,000 miles off the coast of California. But the North Pacific Gyre, this swirling mass of clockwise flowing currents, is roughly twice the size of the United States. So in our study area, 1,000 miles off the coast, we're finding that the accumulation has increased about fivefold in the last 10 years.
And you kind of described it as being kind of like a toilet bowl effect. So what you're saying is this garbage is actually moving around the rim of this circular motion throughout the whole Pacific, even near the Asian coast, is that correct?
Yes. So it extends from, I'd say, Hawaii is in the path of it, about 500 miles off the California coast to 200 miles off the coast of Japan. That entire swath of ocean, roughly 7,000 to 8,000 miles across, is this very slow-moving clockwise currents where plastic debris accumulates. And we're guessing around 3.5 million tons of trash is out there right now.
These things in there, specifically the plastic, are things that are not biodegradable. They're not breaking down in the water. Is that correct?
That's correct. It's not biodegradable. It does break apart by UV light, but it breaks apart into smaller plastic particles. The individual plastic polymers, the molecule of plastic, it's fairly stable. We're turning the oceans into, I call it a plastic soup, is the best analogy. It isn't really an island of plastic. It's more like a very thin soup that stretches across the entire ocean.
And so this plastic, if it was not in the ocean, if it was out of there, it could be recycled, but the problem here is going to be gathering it up and collecting it and bringing it to a place where it can be recycled. Is that true?
I cannot foresee any technological fix to remove the plastic that's in the ocean. It's like trying to sift the Sahara or trying to pull a handful of pepper grains from a salad as big as a Rose Bowl. It's really spread out. I think I like people to really get that this North Pacific gyre is twice the size of the United States. It's like trying to vacuum our country for cigarette butts using a vacuum cleaner. It's impractical. The solution is to simply stop putting in more of this non-biodegradable waste. The single-use disposable plastics, like the petroleum-based plastic forks and cup lids and plastic bags and water bottles and water bottle lids, those things, they have to go.
And even though the effort is being made to recycle and more people are getting involved in trying to put things into their recycle bin and getting it to the companies that are doing this, is that the problem, or is this coming from another place?
Well, the problem and the solutions are that they come from all areas. The consumer is responsible. Our communities are responsible. The industry that makes plastic and the producers who manufacture plastic products, we all have a stake in this. We're all responsible for this garbage patch. So the consumer needs to cut back. I mean, it'd be nice for the consumer to stop using disposable plastics, to use one water bottle one time and then throw it away, discard it, even try to recycle it. Is still a culture of consumption. We still have very poor return rates for recyclables. It would be nice to see the plastics industry look for alternatives, maybe even go back to glass and paper, paper is not the best solution either. The best solution is just to bring your own bags, your own water bottles, your own coffee mugs, things that my grandparents did 50 years ago. I've seen grandmothers still pushing carts at the grocery store. I've seen people bringing their own thermos bottles still. Those ideas that worked for this country 50 years ago are what we need to do now to stop this plastic plague in the ocean.
And besides that, besides just getting away from plastics entirely and recycling everything we're using to carry our liquids and our groceries and things like that, there was a bill here in Oregon to expand the deposit, and part of that deposit would be included would be plastic water bottles, but that failed, and the industry put in quite a bit of money to lobby the legislature here to not do that. Are these part of the problems, is with our politicians really not standing up for us to stop this problem?
Well, the industry is they're very powerful. If you consider how much plastic we produce in the United States, 15 years ago we made roughly 60 billion pounds of plastic in the U.S. alone. And now, 15 years later, we're making 120 billion pounds of plastics. We've doubled production in just 15 years. It's very profitable, and the industry doesn't want to stop making the stuff. So every time I go speak to a state senate or a city council hearing, there's always the American Chemistry Council or Plastic Bag Alliance that's standing behind me, getting equal time to speak about why we need to continue using petroleum-based plastics. So they have a very powerful lobby. I'm not sure, I'd be hesitant to say that their interests are the same as yours and mine, but they are able to convince our policymakers that if we don't continue making plastic products, that we're going to lose jobs. People aren't going to want to do it anyway because of the inconvenience of glass and metal and paper. Their arguments are very weak, but their motives are very clear.
Is basically the petroleum-based plastics that are causing the problem. So for an example, if we were to switch to biodegradable plastics, is that going to help solve part of this problem?
Plant-based plastics like PLA and PHA, although they're a different product, they do biodegrade. They do not biodegrade so well in the marine environment. They do great in an industrial size, let's say a city-sized compost bin, where it's very hot, it's warm, it's moist and full of microbes. Their bioplastics decompose. In the marine environment, not so. The best solution, once again, is to bring your own cloth bag, bring your own coffee mug, your own water bottle.
So absolutely, the only solution here to stop this growing amount of garbage is to stop using plastics entirely.
Sure. Every single coastline I've been to is inundated with plastics, some more than others, depends on the currents and the wind. But every coastline, I mean, our signature for this age of civilization is plastic. I'd call it the plasticine, because we are creating a layer of plastic around the world. And it's, if you look at what's available, the alternatives are there. I mean, we should use the precautionary principle. We know that that's a huge environmental impact. There's also a potential human health impact that I think people should know about. Plastic marine debris, once out in the ocean, it becomes a sponge for many kinds of toxins like PCBs and pesticides and oil drops from cars. Those pollutants stick to plastic at really high concentrations. And we're finding that up to 300 species so far have been found to ingest plastic. We're finding now the current research is when an animal eats plastic particles, thinking it's food typically, does that pollution that sticks to it migrate from the plastic back into the organism? And then does that pollution bioaccumulate up the food chain onto your dinner plate? Is it in your sushi? That's the next question. Is there a human health issue attached to this? We have this conception that we can throw things away. And the reality is there is no away. It goes somewhere. The trash goes somewhere. Half of plastic produced in the United States goes to municipal landfills. The 20% goes to durable goods, things that might last for 5-10 years, like computers or circuit boards, car bumpers, which may go to landfill anyway. Only 5% gets recycled. 25%, what's left behind, is unaccounted for, and we're finding it in our oceans, on our beaches.
You've been listening to Follow the Garbage, a KBOO News special report featuring Suzanne LeGrand, Beth Crawford, Richard Umania, Don Wolf, Katie Arends, and Ryan White. I'm Lisa Loving. Thanks for being with us.
And thank you, Sprouts. Again, my encourage the folks who put on this program, those who are listening, to make sure it doesn't run so much overtime, because I have a guest coming in at 6:15. You're now tuned to Bathrop's Piers Broadsides. I'm Robert Norris, and the guest, hopefully, calling in from criminal activity on the streets down in, I guess that's going to be Venice, Santa Monica, or Los Angeles. She's a homeless activist named Peggy Lee Kennedy. Stay tuned for her. We're actually going to skip the musical introduction because the Sprouts overtime took up that space, and that's okay. That can happen. We did have to cut it off a little bit before its time, so to speak. And hopefully those of you who want to can, of course, Google for the show Sprouts and check out the ending of the show. Actually, we actually caught the ending. I was going to cut it off 5 minutes ago, but I try to respect Free Radio Santa Cruz programmers even when they delve into my show time. Oh, boy. So anyway, this is a program that goes from 6 to 8, although, as regular listeners know all too well. We're concerning ourselves with homeless issues here and in other cities, and also issues of poverty and justice, and some other issues, too, such as the war in Iraq and police misconduct. City council activities is a local issue we cover. The city council race is happening, too. We're going to be talking about that, I suppose, in the days to come, though I really think we need to talk about the issues the city council race will not be covering, which is probably far more important than the issues that they will be talking about. Even if, of course, what they have to say at these city council forums often bears little relation to what they do once they're elected. And as those of you may know who've looked at the candidate list, we have five former city councilmen / mayors running for city council. And that's likely to be, four of those five are likely to win, but we'll see. I've put in a call to some of the other council candidates. We have a call. Hi, you're on Free Radio with Robert.
Yes, hello, Robert. This is Lloyd speaking.
Hey, Lloyd, of the Coalition for Just This and Just That and Justice, hopefully, here and there.
Yes, racism, justice.
It's actually a coalition kind of spearheaded by Simba Kenyatta and
Tony Madrigal, whom I don't think badly of either one of them. Perhaps we could have a little
disagreement.
Yeah, I know. We could have a little, perhaps you could, inform me
well,
better.
Well, Lloyd, here's the deal. This evening, I have a guest coming on at 6:15 who will be calling in shortly.
Right. We got a couple of seconds here. I'd rather talk about what happened in Palestine.
In Palestine.
Yes. Scott Kennedy just came back from there. And apparently nobody has ever tried to break the...
You know, this subject cannot be dealt with in a few seconds, and frankly, if I let you talk about it, there are going to be other people who are going to want to discuss it from the other side. Why don't you call back in about an hour and 15 minutes? I actually have two guests coming onto the air.
I've got so many issues. Is there something we could talk about for a minute?
Go ahead.
Ask me a question.
Well, how did the coalition meeting last Wednesday go? You were there.
I was there. It opened up with a long speech in Spanish.
Folks expressed their concern about issues of police misconduct a lot, right?
No. Mostly what we had were mothers who... There were several mothers of children Hispanic children in the school system that had been very unfortunately extremely mistreated.
Lloyd, by teachers or by?
Yes, the teachers and the other students ganging up on them, and the teacher going, "Well, that he's a troublemaker," and just horrible abuse.
Well, I'm not sure. Is the dynamic because of race? Or
yes.
It's because of race. Okay.
Yes.
These are white schools with Hispanic students, or Hispanic majorities ganging up on whites,
no.
Or. Filipinos ganging up on Taiwanese kids.
White kids ganging up on Hispanic kids.
Okay, well,
making fun of them for starting out with making fun of them for their name, and then just outrageously beating on their ass.
Well, your minute is just about up here. How about calling back in about an hour and a half?
Okay, yeah, even that one's a little more than a minute. So let's see, what could we say here about that's a minute long?
No, you've already done your minute.
Oh, we did it.
Yeah.
That was it.
Yeah, we don't have time. 3 minutes she's calling in. I got to give an introduction. So,
okay,
Lloyd,
later.
Call back.
I'll call back in an hour.
Yeah, Lloyd, give your number for those who want to call in instances of police misconduct.
If you'd like to talk about instances of police abuse.
Yeah.
You can call Lloyd Ellis at 457-2406. I have access to media. We could get you on community TV if you want.
That sounds great.
But,
okay, Lloyd,
you know, we could complain, and I'll walk you through the county building and file a complaint against a police officer.
Here, here. 457-2406. Call back, Lloyd. Thanks for calling in. Sorry to cut you off. I am, again, pressed for time. Again, at 6:45, unless he cancels, which he may do because of we've just been made aware that the some group of party hacks is holding a coronation ceremony in Denver, which may make it difficult for ordinary mortals to talk about real issues because they're monopolizing the airwaves. So we may want to postpone Jim Gottstein's activities, actually his presentation about his briefs against forced drugging for a little while. But here's our main caller here for the moment, and this is who it is. Hey there, you're on Free Radio.
Hi, it's Peggy Kennedy from Venice, California.
Peggy Lee Kennedy, as I sit and breathe here. I was looking online at your website, wetnostril.net.
Right.
And I was checking. I didn't have much chance
the
to.
The Justice Committee website part of the page.
Yes. It's wetnostril all one word .net/justice. And, you know, I notice you've got some interesting videos, which I haven't been able to view yet. You're going after L.A. Municipal Code 80.69.4, the new oversized vehicle permit law. Sounds a bit like harassment in the Santa Cruz area around this.
Mm-hmm.
And it looks like you have a couple of other laws. You're also going after a city law about overnight parking districts.
Overnight parking districts, or OPD. They call it the OPDs, which are fast spreading all over the city of Los Angeles. And it's a law they put in that restricts parking to only permit holders between the hours of 2 and 6 in the morning. It specifically targets people living in vehicles.
So is there, I mean, we have a similar law. We actually, it's somewhat worse. So it was originally brought to us by retiring council member and luckily defeated Assemblywoman aspirant Emily Riley. But it was passed by the entire council, including such great liberals as Tony Madrigal, who's running again for city council. These are people you don't know, but the people I'm talking to here locally do, Peggy. And that's the reason I mention them. But the time period was longer here. I think it's 12 to 6 a.m. And the main justification for these so-called, we call them permit parking districts here in Santa Cruz, is to stop tourists and students from taking up all the available parking places. But that's normally during the day. It's a sort of a two-hour limit on parking unless you have a permit. But the only reason for making a ban on parking at night at all unless you have a permit seems to be, and I think it was explicitly stated to be the case, at least here in Santa Cruz, to eliminate overnight camping or sleeping in your vehicle. Are they as explicit there in Los Angeles? Are they acknowledging we just want to get rid of them homeless people?
Pretty much. Every once in a while they forget to say that. And they say, quality of life nuisances or issues or crime issues. But you know, sleeping and living in your vehicle is a crime. So that is the crime that they're trying to get rid of. But if you follow the paper trail, it says almost every single each district that they make is passed by ordinance or by motion or resolution through the city council. So you can't create an actual district without a paper trail of some sort. And they get, this documentation from the Department of Transportation that says, oh, yes, there is a crime problem there. Well, the crime is people living in their vehicles, which is against the law in the city of Los Angeles.
Peggy,
so,
let me ask you this. One of the, we've had this, the same crime bugaboo boogeyman used here in Santa Cruz to make it illegal to sit in your vehicle for 16 minutes in a public parking lot any time of the day or night, or to enter a parking lot and sit down and talk to someone there or linger and chat with someone unless you have a car or bicycle there. That's Mayor Ryan Coonerty's law. He's running for re-election. Please don't re-elect him. But my question, I guess, is My observation first is that in presenting this parking, I call it the parking lot panic law, they call it the parking lots and garages trespass law. They claim a crime problem, but they don't provide the specific stats that show the kinds of crimes they're talking about, the indication that there's been any improvement in those areas where they actually put such laws into force. Now, what's happened in Los Angeles? Is there a similar lack of information?
Never have they provided us with any statistics. It's just blah, blah, blah. So, they say, the neighborhood prosecutor has indicated that there is a crime problem. But it's just like saying homeless people are pooing in your yard. Where is the evidence? There's no evidence. I have no evidence. Show me the poo in the yard, and then I'll believe it.
Or the citation for pooing, or the complaint about the pooing, something that's tangible.
Oh, well, people complain, but I think they make it up. They're stirring up this hysteria because, why would somebody go poo in the middle of your yard? That's probably a dog, unless they're really targeting you, and you're just a really horrid person.
Well, have you considered a poo-in at the police department or the city council, perhaps?
Yeah, that's a good idea, actually.
Yeah, it would be sort of a smelly affair, but people could wear the appropriate... Actually, I think a shit-in was used in the Chicago airports to deal with discrimination in the late 60s by Saul Alinsky, although I don't have a specific recollection of, where, when that actually happened, whether it was him who did it. We're talking with Peggy Lee Kennedy, who's an activist in Santa Monica, Venice, and Los Angeles. Works with the Justice Committee. Actually, I think you created the Justice Committee. Did you create that single-handedly, or did you have any help with that?
No, it was Calvin and I, and Calvin Moss, and we worked with and still often work with a few lawyers. So basically, the Justice Committee was because of Michael Zinzin. We were going and learning about documenting police abuse, and he recommended that we create a Justice Committee. And so the Justice Committee is really the Justice Committee and media group. We're, we have a lot of footage, and we need to, work harder at putting it out there so more people can see it.
Yeah, I see some videos. We actually, up here in Santa Cruz, have a few websites, too, for those who are listening and who don't know. One is Huff Santa Cruz, HUFFSantaCruz.org. Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom. Huff is the abbreviation for it. HuffSantaCruz.org. Another is run by Tenderfoot Tim Rumford. It's Humanity for Homeless, all one word, all small letters, humanityforhomeless.blogspot.com. And then I believe there's a third site, sleepisaright.blogspot.com, which was originally part of the sleeping ban lawsuit before it was discontinued or maybe indefinitely suspended until the next round of attorneys shows up and the next round of fundraisers shows up. And all these websites have interesting and useful information on them. So does yours. Again, wetnostril.net/justice.
Let me tell you, you can get to that page easier by just putting in www.justice.wetnostril.net.
Uh-huh.
And that'll take you right to the page.
Right. What I did was I just Googled for Peggy Lee Kennedy, and I got that first one.
You found me.
I found you, and you found your website. I also noticed you have links to find someone in the L.A. County Jail, Food Not Bombs, National Lawyers Guild, ACLU, National Low Income Housing Coalition, a number of others. You actually find the ACLU helps you in L.A. I know that ACLU, with Carol Sobel's help of the National Lawyers Guild, they put together the pleadings for the Jones case, which resulted in the Jones settlement in Los Angeles, which
I think people get confused because I think people get a little confused because Carol Sobel was with the ACLU for many years, but she is no longer with the ACLU.
Well, I'm not confused. I know she's with the National Lawyers Guild, and I know that she created that brief, but the ACLU, I think, used a lot of it. I don't know if they gave her credit or not, and we've talked a lot about that brief over the last 2 years, and I think it's been used in other cities, or at least it's been certainly looked at in San Diego, who also overturned, L.A. overturned its sit lie law, its sleeping law, in return.
L.A. It's LAMC 41.18.
Right. You can't sit, lie, or sleep anywhere at any time on any sidewalk in the city of Los Angeles.
Yeah, well,
now,
they figure out ways to get around it,
right,
though, don't
but
they?
The law is, it's been technically, there's now an injunction in place or a settlement which requires you to allow people to sleep at night, and if right, they're 10 mm-hmm. feet from a building until a certain amount of housing is built, right?
Yeah, good luck. We'll wait. We won't hold our breath for that to happen.
Right, and I would love to hear an update. If you have an update on how the police are using other means to harass people, I assume with littering tickets, probation checks, drug laws, things of that sort. But
I've been so busy with the overnight parking districts lately that I haven't really. I need to keep up more on what's going on with Skid Row because I know it's a lot. But in Venice, it's the struggle is really strong right now. The police are, banging on campers and towing them and sweeping every couple of, twice a week. And it's a madness. So it's hard to keep up on what's going on.
Have you gotten in touch, Peggy, with Glenn Maurer of Santa Barbara? I know that he has successfully fought Santa Barbara's attempt to criminalize people in their vans. He was, of course, the chief public defender for a number of years. Then he was with a similar group. It wasn't the Justice Committee. It's another group of a similar name in Santa Barbara. We've had him on the air. He worked with Peter Marin and Nancy McCready of the Homeless Coalition there. You might want to get in touch with him because he's successfully beaten back a lot of the Santa Barbara laws. You might have a few tips for you.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
Yeah, call me up after the show, and I'll give you his name and number. Glenn Maurer is his name.
Yes, I will. I'll email you.
And you're actually out on the streets, right? You're out there feeding people food. Are you feeding them illegally? Is that what's going on?
No, I'm not.
Come on now.
What if I was?
Oh, your criminals are all like, you're just encouraging these homeless. They flock to you like pigeons.
Yeah, that horrible job of giving away food. Yes, we are on the corner. We're actually right on Lincoln Boulevard. It's part of Highway 1. Giving away food right now. It's every Thursday we have a big, huge food giveaway.
Now, where are you? Are you in Venice or Santa Monica?
Venice, right on Lincoln Boulevard. It's part of Highway 1.
Now, I know Santa Monica, didn't it recently, a couple years ago, pass a law that cut back feeding, and there was an ACLU challenge. What's the status of feeding programs in Santa Monica and Venice for those who want to give out sandwiches to the poor?
You still do it because we sued them.
You sued them?
Yes, we sued them. It's Santa Monica Food Not Bombs versus the city of Santa Monica.
And who won?
We did. And people think that the city won, but the fact is that they did something while it was in the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, is they kept changing the law to fix it so that it wouldn't be unconstitutional. So that finally when we were heard in the Ninth Circuit, that there was only one bit left that was still unconstitutional. So, and then they had to change that.
Have they successfully cut back the size of the groups you can feed or anything else?
Yes, they did do that. So it has to be under 150.
So do they have little people with clickers there counting how many homeless people are being fed and saying, you're 151, get out of here?
Probably.
Really?
We did things to confuse them, so... You know, you could always have two lines and call yourself a different food program. You could go on carts and you could have two groups starting at different type tops. What we did is we had multiple carts and we met in the middle. And then in the middle we had a food line. I mean, we did some interesting things to confuse them.
We had similar kinds of activities here in Santa Cruz when they went after us 20 years ago and then again, I guess 15 years ago. And of course, San Francisco Food Not Bombs fights this fight pretty regularly. And of course, it's still going on in places like Florida and I guess Nevada.
Florida they won.
Yeah,
Orlando,
the real way to win is not to stop. I mean, because the public sentiment still believes, I think, that. However much it may alarm the horses and disturb upper middle class business people who want to, create a homeless free scene, there are other people who have religious beliefs about the rights the duty of caring for the poor, and even then there are those who on the right wing and the left wing who believe in the constitutional right to be able to share a sandwich with someone. So you've got a lot of public support in that. Have you been hassled by the police in the last year for feeding people at the spot you're at?
Well, we give away food in multiple places. This is our food giveaway. It's not cooked. It's just, you know, straight giveaway. And we do that on Lincoln and out of a church parking lot.
Mm-hmm.
And when we do our Food Not Bombs prepared food on Sunday, that's on the Venice Beach boardwalk. And, yeah, that's been rough going, although we sued them about the boardwalk ordinance, Venice Food Not Bombs versus the city of Los Angeles.
And that was about a food giveaway or about their street performer ordinance?
Well, both, because I was giving away food and it's a vending ordinance, and they arrested me in June 2006 for violating a vending law when I was giving away free food. Actually, I was videotaping, but they said I violated the vending law. But we won, and we have, it's now legal to give away. I mean, it's actually written in that law that it's legal to give away food down there now. So I think that's a big deal.
Has the written law produced less food giveaways because of the nature of the restrictions in the law, or are things pretty much as they were in 2001?
Things are not the same because of the amount of the harassment, and there's less homeless people and there's more bizarre harassment. We're certain that there was some bizarre undercover or something things happening to us recently down there.
Like
but
what?
This one, you know, just people that don't look like they're homeless and they don't look like they're hungry coming up, and they scope us out and they see our little plastic gloves and they're trying to figure out some kind of thing to say to us, and then they accuse us of having food that's going to make somebody sick, and then there's other people mysteriously leaving full plates of food that they don't look like they're homeless or hungry, and then somebody gets hysterical and throws the food at us, and looks like a show. It looks like it's orchestrated, some kind of a play.
How often has that happened?
Well, the thing is it's something different every time, so it's hard to track.
Now, are you videoing this still? Are you keeping a record of what goes on?
Yes, we do. We videotape a lot of the activity, and that's part of our problem of keeping it updated. There's so much video coming in and so much activity that to keep up with, especially with these parking restrictions that are coming in, because we just had a really bad decision on
overnight parking districts.
Because it's in the these districts are in the coastal zone, they had to get a coastal commission, you know, a California Coastal Commission permit, one of the coastal permits. And to do the permit, they were supposed to do a study, and the city spent $75,000 of the surplus property fund. Our so-called liberal city council person designated $75,000 out of this fund to expedite the study, because our Bureau of Engineering was so understaffed that they couldn't do it toot sweet. And they had to get an independent contractor who didn't even do a parking study, but they held this hearing, and we all came out opposing it. It was huge. It's obvious that Venice was opposed to this permit parking. And it was very heartening. Everybody was, you know, it was rousing. Everybody was so excited. There was still this many people that cared about the poor and criminalizing those living in vehicles. And then exactly to the day, 1 month later, they rubber stamped it on the 26th. And so we have 10 days to appeal that. So we're now strategizing on the appeals.
And so what exactly was rubber stamped? The right of the city to ban vehicles of a certain size?
To put the permits in.
To require permits.
Yeah, it's okay to put the permits in this coastal zone area. That's fine. And, you know, let's go on to the Coastal Commission next. So we have 10 days to appeal it, so we're working on
it. Does it cost you money to appeal it?
Oh, gee, I don't know. They haven't even bothered. I've been asking for the appeals form.
Because, see, Santa Cruz City Council, in a move to discourage appeals from its planning and zoning boards, used to be $50 to appeal. Now I believe it's $500 to appeal.
Oh, well, I hope it isn't Well, I don't know. We'll just have to wait and see to get the form. So, you know, there's an official form you appeal with. So we've all asked for it.
We're talking with Peggy Lee Kennedy. What group do you represent aside from Venice Food Not Bombs? And the, I guess, is it the Justice Committee? What is it exactly?
It's the Venice Justice Committee and Media Group. Let's see, what group? We also have a Peace and Justice Pantry.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's as much as I can come up with right now.
Now, are you actually standing on the corner giving out muffins as we speak, or what's happening?
No, it's produce and chips, and we actually got dog food this time and a big thing of watermelon. And
dog food. Dog food, hopefully for the dogs and not for the people.
People who had dogs.
Some of us survived
really
on dog
excited.
Food in the 70s, though. I remember.
Look, we have dogs, and people have dogs, and they're so excited to get the dog food. I'm sitting in my car because I couldn't have heard you because of the traffic on Lincoln Boulevard.
Uh-huh.
So I'm out here, and Calvin's giving food away. There's an organization we support in downtown that gives away food to people in MacArthur Park, and they're here picking up their share. And we've got one more load going to another food program.
Have you invited Obama to come and distribute food to the masses, perhaps?
Oh, yeah, I'm sure, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Or his Democratic buddies?
I'd rather ask Ralph Nader.
He might be equally unlikely. I mean, he might offend some of the Green Party people
he's on the Peace and Freedom ticket.
Oh, he's on the Peace and Freedom ticket.
Yeah, in California, yeah.
Well, that's a good point, because I know the last time he came through Santa Cruz in 2000, I think he came through again, but when he came through in 2000, he didn't want to offend Councilmember Tim Fitzmaurice and Mayor Keith Sugar, so he wouldn't answer a question. Well, the answer he gave to the question of should homeless people be allowed to sleep at night is the city's anti-homeless don't sleep after 11 o'clock at night on any public property at all. Ordinance,
uh-oh,
constitutional, or good idea. He said he would prefer affordable housing, which is exactly what Democrats will tell you if you ask about criminalization.
They always say, and then there's no housing.
Of course. And there is no housing. There won't be any housing to cover most of the homeless population for the foreseeable future, and therefore that's an evasive and essentially deceptive answer, and it's too bad that Nader made that. He had made that question, as I know myself, because I raised it, and I actually recorded it when he came through. Maybe he's changed his tune. Who knows? You never can tell.
Oh, that's sad. But, sad to hear. Well, maybe I better consider Cynthia McKinney.
Well, I don't. You should ask both of them how they stand. I mean, the Green Party, for example, has a good California State Party platform on the homeless. But if you look at the Greens, like Mike Feinstein, I guess he was your Green Santa Monica mayor.
Yeah.
He went for harsher legislation in the 90s against the homeless. And I guess getting to the original reason I called you, which you candidly told me, because you're really tied up with this overnight parking district nonsense that you're fighting.
Yeah.
You didn't have a time to read the Santa Monica's latest beggars can't be sitters law that they're coming up with, which bans sitting while you panhandle. We have a similar kind of law, which is actually broader in Santa Cruz. You are, in theory, you're not allowed to sit on any. Actually, the wording is you can't sit on any public property while panhandling, even if you're doing so silently with a sign, even if you're doing so more than 14 feet from a building, which is another provision, even if you're doing so during the day, you're not allowed to do it at night, even if you're
That's
doing so
disgusting.
Not at a bus stop, not in a group of more than two, actually it's more than one, if there are two of you, I think you have to sit 3 feet apart.
Okay, well, this is what I read in a newspaper, which I don't necessarily believe. But they may be quoting the gist of the law correctly, I'm not sure, is that it's only on 3rd Street Promenade, which is a shopping district. So, which makes sense, because the city of Santa Monica does these sorts of things as they pass these, it's a city, and it's a dense city of rich people. And the per capita, whatever, and the location, there's a lot of people there. But the fact is, it's a very rich little city. And they get to make their own laws, and the city council stays up half the night making these and talking about these little laws.
And we're talking about Venice or Santa
Monica? No, Santa Monica. Santa Monica is a city itself. Venice is part of the city of Los Angeles. So, so Santa Monica, it fools you with all this liberal green, but they just get worse and worse towards the homeless. They are so mean, you know, with all their laws. So I wasn't surprised at this, latest panhandling law on Third Street Prominent, but I've researched some of their laws because people get tickets, and I find it amazing. And how do the police remember all these silly laws? They're for the benches that are near Third Street Promenade. Another, you know, there's all these little laws for districts. So I'm not surprised that they would pass a law for just Third Street Promenade because it's a big tourist attraction, you know, with all these big corporate shopfront.
I read this story from the LA Times last a week or two ago, and I know that you were going to call in, but you got kind of sidetracked on that. And it talks about prohibiting solicitation by anyone sitting on public chairs or benches on the Third Street Promenade in the so-called transit mall. It's really, I mean, although it gets a lot of publicity in the LA Times, well, it gets a story anyway. In Santa Cruz, we've had, you know, laws that are many times worse. They were actually initiated by the liberal progressive faction of city council, then headed by our supervisor, then our mayor, and then the council member, Neil Coonerty, the owner of the liberal bookshop Santa Cruz. His son is now Mayor Ryan Coonerty, and he, in the family tradition, has passed even worse laws, making it illegal to this parking lot panic law I told you about.
But do you think that there are any liberals left in office? Don't you think they're all just neoliberals?
Well, if you look at the Board of Supervisors in San Francisco, for example.
They're more liberal?
They're big into, they go through the affordable housing thing. But they attempted, you know, I think they work with the Coalition on Homelessness in eliminating tickets that come in, although they haven't, you know, they haven't changed the laws that allow the police to criminalize, and it's mainly the mayor, Gavin Newsom, who pushes the stuff in San Francisco, and the supervisors, the liberal majority in San Francisco, there is a majority there which is more liberal than I would say in most other cities I've heard of, and you also, of course, you know, you have the positive impact of the Jones decision, or the Jones settlement. The Jones decision was vitiated, but the Jones settlement in Los Angeles, you know, which lets the homeless people sleep down there, and is a constant kind of potential threat to places like Fresno, Sacramento, Richmond, San Diego, and other cities that haven't really officially changed their laws, like San Francisco. That's one theory I have. We're talking with Peggy Lee Kennedy, and I have some bad news for folks out there who are waiting for Jim Gottstein to come on. Jim, suddenly realizing that it's Democratic convention night, has decided to postpone his appearance on the air with my permission, or after advising me of it. We talked about it a little bit on the email because he wants people to be able to hear what he has to say. This is an attorney, Peggy, from Alaska, who has written the kind of definitive brief for fighting forced drugging and forced hospitalization. To show, you know, he actually won the case in the Alaska Supreme Court that showed the psychiatrists have to show before the court that that's the least restrictive alternative. It can't just be rubber stamped up there. Now, whether they're going to actually follow this or not is another issue. But he is helping legal authorities, legal public defenders, legal psychiatric rights fighters, rights of the psychiatric survivors rather than the rights of the psychiatrists, you know, or the rights of the families to stand up against this. Sounds like
that's
we got
great.
A caller. I think someone may have a question for you or may just be calling in. Hang on. Hi, you're on Free Radio with Peggy and Robert.
I'm on right now.
Yes, you are.
Oh, hi, Robert.
Hi.
Let me go turn the radio down, okay, please?
Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah. So anyway, Peggy, I wanted to make that brief announcement about Jim, and I'll tell
this. When's he gonna come on?
I think he'll be coming on. He's gonna reschedule either a week from today.
I just
hang on, caller. Just a second. We have someone else on the line with you.
Okay.
Her name is Peggy, and she's in Venice. She's in Venice giving away food to poor people on the streets.
Well, good for her.
Yeah,
thank you.
Well, the reason there's so many poor people in this country right now, and more people hungry and homeless is because of the war. I figured it out. All that money that's going to the war could have been for helping, having a comprehensive medical for all the people. And I really think Obama will get it done. And I'd like to say I'm a survivor. I've spent...
Hang on, caller. First of all, why don't we... Do you want to say who you are?
I'd rather not say.
You have a secret identity. Okay. All right. Well, we've been talking...
The mystery woman.
Yeah, that's... Well, I'm glad you're calling in. I know you called in last show, and you've said some important things, actually, when you gave your name some shows ago, so some of us are in the know.
Well, it doesn't matter. I have a message to say.
Go ahead. But again, you know, you usually it's best to listen to the show and then respond to what we're talking about rather than sort of use it simply to broadcast your message because we're talking about...
No, this relates to what you're talking about.
Oh, good. Okay, go ahead then.
Well, everything relates to everything anyway, but I want to say that I've spent two-thirds of my life either homeless, locked in jails for political work, or in mental institutions. And I know a lot about mental institutions, and there's a Holocaust going on in this country. And it's even touching children, with parents thinking, being convinced that the only way to control their children and have power over them or whatever is force drugging.
Caller, what does this have to do with what we're talking about?
Well, she just mentioned something about force drugging. You talked about somebody.
Well, I mentioned that the person who's going to be discussing this issue, Jim Gottstein, isn't going to call until either next week. That's what I said.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you could just call up.
You're welcome to discuss
this. I don't have much time, but I just want to say I'm a survivor, mm-hmm. and I want to tell people to watch out for the evil psychiatric empire. The drugs that they're giving people, it started the whole thing like that in Nazi Germany, and some of them can cause very bad things. Like, for instance, I bought a pill box today, and I brought it home, and I can't even find it because I have had so many bad seizures and hit my head so hard that I have, from psychiatric drugs, that I have now developed epilepsy.
That's something that Gottstein, the attorney who will be calling in a week or so, has actually been able to put into a brief using research from the book by Robert Whitaker called Mad in America,
mm-hmm.
and another by...
I got to hang up now because I have a real sore throat.
All right. Well, thanks for calling in,
God
caller.
Bless you all.
Thank you.
Yeah. What's happening, Peggy, with... are you having a lot of, harassment of homeless people using psychiatric stuff, psychiatric holds and so forth?
Yeah, I'm really concerned about that. But, you know... The problem with this situation with the psychiatric holds are we don't really have that many hospitals or good hospitals here. So if you get put on a hold, they quite possibly will give you some really crummy medication. But more people are going to L.A. County Jail than anything else. And let's say you did have some medication that you really did need, like blood pressure, or you were sick and you needed your medicine, or you had hepatitis, or there was some medical condition you needed care for, or let's say even if you wanted to take, psychiatric drugs, once you get into L.A. County Jail, forget it. It's a nightmare. And that is the place people are being housed here. This is where... people are going, not hospitals, L.A. County Jail. That's where you go. They ticket you, and then they wait till you get, a good amount of warrants, and then they take you to jail, and that's where you are, and you go to court, and they go, okay, time served, but now you're on probation for a year, and you have a stay-away order from Venice, or you have a stay-away order from Skid Row, and that's where the services are. So it's like it's a nightmare, and it's a process of extermination. And, the L.A. County Jail isn't quite a concentration camp where they're outright, killing everybody. People are being tortured to death through this process.
Let me ask you, Peggy, I know that we recently, 3 or 4 months ago, we heard about Ontario, California, in San Bernardino County, where the city had actually set up a tent city, and then they started restricting it severely. Have you heard anything more about that, or have there been any other efforts in the L.A. area, greater L.A. area, that involve emergency housing for homeless people run by homeless people?
Oh, God. Well, I don't know, was the Ontario one run by homeless people? I mean, I know there were a lot of people going there and volunteering. I knew some people that were going there and volunteering, and I know David Bush went down there and did some activist work, but I think the city was trying to control
it. No, I think you're right. I think it was.
I mean, it would be nice if there were places, but L.A. City and this area, Southern California, this whole area, it's really rotten. If you tried to start a community, homeless-run community, you know, you can bet there's going to be some serious police activity.
Are you still putting out the homeless newspaper, Making Change, in the Santa Monica?
I don't really have. I haven't seen one lately, so I don't know what's happening with the Making Change.
How about underground radio stations like our Free Radio Santa Cruz? Are there such stations in your area?
Well,
I don't know is an acceptable answer if you don't know, you know. So
I don't really know. I mean, I'm just there is one downtown, but we don't get it, and I don't remember the name of it. So
how about cop watching? Do you have, you're obviously doing cop watching with your video camera at work?
Yep.
Are you?
Yeah, our justice committee is the cop watch of this area. So
and how about the LA Coalition Against Hunger and Homelessness?
They do cop watch in Skid Row. But they don't call it cop watch.
LA Can, I think, is what they call themselves.
Yeah, LA Can, but they call it community watch.
Uh-huh.
Or something like that. And they go out and they've been arrested. So, you know, they had a rash of arrests of people videotaping down there. I know there's some false arrests.
Are there any? I mean, are lawsuits having an impact at all in terms of? We saw the Jones decision. There was a prior lawsuit that the ACLU recently was able to renew, which said that you can't stop people for parole and probation violations. You can't just stop them aimlessly looking for potential parolee and probation violators. You have to have a reasonable suspicion to even talk to a person on the street in an involuntary way. People, you know, cops can always come up to you and say, hey, what's cooking? Let's see your ID. And you can say, officer, am I free to go? I'll talk to you later. And unless they have reasonable suspicion, they can't force you to stay. Even if they force you to stay, of course, they can't force you to show ID, which most people don't know because they want to, you know, please the officer. Do you have any?
Well, you have to make your own decision. In general, I keep ID on me because just in case they accuse me of committing a crime. So when they want to issue me a violation so that I show my ID so that they don't arrest me, they could just ticket me and I could keep on going.
Does people use the take me to a magistrate section of the law, as they do here a bit in Santa Cruz, not a lot, but somewhat? Are you familiar with that section of the law?
Pardon me?
There's a section of the law, the state law, which says that if a police officer wants to, say, write you an infraction citation, like I'm assuming these, parking district tickets or panhandling tickets or sleeping tickets are, I assume that they're infractions and not misdemeanors?
No, misdemeanors.
They are misdemeanors down there.
Well, I don't know about the panhandling ticket, but they're misdemeanors. These municipal codes are misdemeanors, living in your vehicle.
I think you also have
sidewalk one.
I think even with misdemeanors, you have the right to demand to be taken to a magistrate. If the ticket is given to you during the business hours of a court, you can say, take me to a magistrate under the code section. And they have to actually take you to a judge. They can't just jail you. And is that used much down in Los Angeles or Venice?
I doubt it. I think people are more or less in so much fear. There's so many police. Like, in May, they hired 20 more police just for our little area in Venice. And it's insane. They don't have enough to do. There's three cars doing one traffic stop. And, you know, I think people are in more in fear.
That sounds a bit like Santa Cruz. We have our entire police contingent. They're now all up to snuff and rolling right along, even as the voters voted down recently a ballot measure that would provide for emergency services, because they're concerned that the money would go to the city council, which is squandering it on things like the police, who are using their time not to get the rapists and the big-time criminals, but to go after the petty infractions and to crack down further down on the, you know, Pacific Avenue. At least this is the concern a lot of us have.
Well, you know, we have Chief Bratton. He's king of this quality of life policing. He's well known for it, and he's our chief of police, and that's what it's all about here. Go after the little infractions.
And we have Chief Howard Scary, who's a disciple of...
Howard Scary? Yeah, is that really his name?
Hey, and he the previous police chief was called Steve Belcher. And Steve wrote in his police handbook, he picked up this crap from the broken windows theory of, you know, the Harper's article back in the 80s and from that New York think tank that said, you know, homeless people are like broken windows. You just don't want them lingering around. A broken window creates a climate of crime and all that crap.
Right.
So we're talking with Peggy.
Poor people are criminals. Yeah.
Yeah. Peggy Lee Kennedy here is with the Venice Justice Committee. Is that right?
Sure. Justice Committee or Food Not Bombs.
We'll call you Food Not Bomber too. We're gonna let her go in a minute. But if anybody wants to,
because I think my battery's going dead.
Well, if anybody calls in the next 25 seconds, they could perhaps ask you a question. 427-3772. 427-3772 is a call-in number if you want to ask Peggy a question about Southern California, what's happening down there, or anything you've heard on the air. Again, my apologies to those who tuned in listening for hoping for Jim Gottstein. That's going to happen in a week. Check out Indy Bay. I may have a caller for you here, Peggy. Don't go away.
Okay.
Hi, you're on Free Radio with Peggy and Robert. You were, anyway. Looks like they decided to go somewhere else. Maybe that was a telemarketer.
Oh.
I got a lot of those today.
They got scared.
Yeah, it could be.
Maybe they forgot the question.
Maybe it was the wrong number. Never could tell. Well, Peggy, I appreciate your, you know, doing this call, and you're paying for it yourself at your end. We didn't call you. You called us at our request.
Yep. My minutes.
And, hey, I owe you. So if, you know, you want the check will be in the mail a week from two. Oh, here comes that caller again. Let's see. Hi, you're on Free Radio again with Peggy and Robert.
Yeah, my question is the Ku Klux Klan still a problem in the Los Angeles Police Department? I lived there in the 70s, and they were basically all Klanners. It's just a known fact at the time.
You know what?
And I'd like to know if that racist police department is still up to the same stuff that they were back when.
Well, go ahead, Peggy.
It's a really scary thing, because they've hired a lot of people of color and women, and women of color, and they're training them to be racist.
Yeah, well, back then there was a man of color that was on the force, and he was shot, and his wife was a little upset.
I know, but what I'm saying is they're training them to be the same white racist mentality as the cops.
Okay, so
were
they sign up
70s.
With the Pledge of Allegiance and they don't disagree with anything.
Right, and like a couple years ago, I have an example, and I had an apartment, and on the street behind us was a single family home community, and a friend of mine who is a Vietnam veteran who was living in his vehicle was parked there, and I thought, uh-oh, and so we walked around there to move his vehicle, and there the police already were, two African-American police, and they told this man, and it's this huge white neighborhood of all white people living in this affluent area that's really being gentrified, and they told this Vietnam veteran man, who's a friend of mine, who I was going to cook dinner for, they said, these good people don't want your kind around here. And these are African-American police officers. So, I mean, you know, they're being taught the same white supremacist mentality, even though they're people of color, and I know they might have issues of discrimination within the force, but it's still the same mentality.
Yeah, I get the picture. That's what they're doing these days now down there.
Yeah,
huh?
So it's really sad, you know. And you think that, you know, you really expect different, you know, when you're talking to the officers. But
yeah, Lloyd is with a coalition that's actually been holding hearings throughout the county, trying to get people to come and tell their stories about discrimination, racism, having to do with police and teachers and, I don't know, employers and what other phenomena. Mostly it's, I've noticed when I was there, it was police.
Yeah, we got a new one called economic discrimination, and where they just hassle people in the park based on the economics of, obviously, they're there all day long.
I think that would have really helped that if we would look into the, there is a California Penal Code that requires law enforcement to take some training, this video training, I forget what the name of that, that puts out those cop video trainings, and it talks about hate crimes against homeless people. And maybe it would help them to equate hate and hate crimes with somebody's economic status.
Yeah, the police up here aren't trained either.
Yeah, they're trained to hate.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, the structure of the law, you know, it sort of puts it into legal concrete. This whole, I mean, the sleeping ban in Santa Cruz is a hate crime. You obviously can't survive at night if you can't sleep legally. You know, I mean, you can survive only badly. It's a form of, I think international law recognizes it as a form of torture. Sleep deprivation is a form of torture, and yet we see this throughout, both in Santa Cruz and I imagine in Santa Monica and Venice and Los Angeles. In spite of the Jones decision, you have people enforcing the equivalent of the sleeping ban in different places.
Right. Yes, you do. And, you know, just because somebody's not getting a ticket, if they're hitting you in the ribs with their billy club at 3 in the morning while you're sleeping on a park bench, or if they're banging or putting their boot prints on your RV in the middle of the night, telling them, if you're here in the next hour, I'm towing your rig.
Well, how about if somebody gets killed and they just say, oh, well, out of town or you're next.
Or if they grab you if they grab you by the arm as you try to get into your RV because you don't wish to talk to them and you're not guilty of any crime, and then they wrench you around and slam you to the ground and break your arm as they did Donna Dice on May 9th of this year, and then they will charge you with resisting arrest. She goes back to court in early September in that case. So here we have, when Santa Cruz may not have the Klan and the police force and in the...
No, I'm talking seriously. Klan. These people retire and they go to Utah. They go to whatever, north of Utah. They go live in the Klan neighborhood.
Well, wait a minute. Hold it, you two. Do you actually have any stats that show this? I'll apply the same standard to you as I do to the police. Do you have any evidence of
that's
this?
That's anecdotal. I'm sorry.
Yeah, well, get your... Well,
that's not an exception, though.
Well, I mean, I'd be interested
in
seeing some stats about this.
Or Idaho. It's Idaho.
Idaho, yeah. Idaho. Yeah. That's the Klan neighborhood. Yeah, not what I said. Idaho, yeah. Well,
right. No, that was the guy, the LAPD officer in the what is the football player that?
Yeah, OJ.
OJ.
Yeah, yeah. He wanted to lynch OJ.
Right. Yeah.
And then he went to Idaho.
Well, let's. The anecdotes are fine.
Yeah.
I'd like to see.
You know what? I also affiliate with Anti-Racist Action LA. I'm part of Anti-Racist Action LA, and I, you know what? I'm remiss for not having those statistics because I know they exist.
Well, get those statistics, and we'll bring them up next time. Lloyd, thanks for the call.
Okay.
And Peggy, you've been going strong for 45 minutes. Is there more you want to talk about?
No, I'm going to hang up accidentally on you because of the battery's going to go out in my cell phone pretty soon.
Well, so you might need it to call your attorney, so I'm going to let you go.
Thank you.
Hey, thanks, Peggy. We're talking with Peggy Lee Kennedy in Venice. She's with Venice Food Not Bombs. And if you go to Wet Nostril or Peggy Lee Kennedy, Google for her, you'll find her justice website. It's pretty interesting.
And all I want to say is, everybody, remember the Fifth Amendment, where you don't have to be a witness against yourself and admitting that you're committing a crime.
You don't have to actually talk to a police officer at all, other than to say, A, am I free to go? B, if not, I have nothing to say.
Right.
I'd like to speak to an attorney. I don't consent to any searches. That's it.
I do not consent to a search.
Right.
That's a good one.
Just remember those three sentences, and, you know, then... You know, as they pummel you, you can say, I still did the right thing.
Yeah, well, hope that you get a witness.
Yeah, witnesses are good. At least if you get pummeled, they can't use the evidence in court because, you know, you essentially said, I've got nothing more to say except, that sort of thing, you know.
That's right.
Thank you, Peggy.
Okay, bye.
Bye-bye.
And that was Peggy Lee Kennedy with the Venice Food Not Bombs and her Justice Committee down there. And she's out there walking the walk, giving out food, fighting lawsuits, winning some of them, too. I didn't talk about all the lawsuits she's won, and trying to make connections to hold off the flood of, I call it the right-wing riptide. Anyway, you're tuned to Free Radio, 101.1 FM, freakradio.org on the net. My name's Norse, Robert Norse, family name Khan, for those who are interested. But I use the name Robert Norse because that's the one that I've had for 20 years. I use it in writing and I use it in speaking and so forth. And this is your opportunity to speak on the air, too, for the next hour. We go from 7 to 8. Twice a week this show airs. There's also a showing on, or an airing on Sunday, longer, starts at 9:30 or even sometimes earlier, runs till 1 and sometimes later in the afternoon. And I often do a lot of street interviews. I've actually got some here. I suspect some people out there are waiting for a report from the Sunday ACLU Hammer of Justice Award that Mayor Ryan Coonerty was given. We'll have more on that after this musical interlude.
This old town has had its day. All the people moved away, and the houses standing empty in the dry and the dusty day. No one cares for this old town. Now the money's not around, and the railway lines are rusty, and the station's falling down. There's a light down the line, let it shine, shine, let it shine. There's a camp down the way. All the fettlers will be coming home today. When the railway opened here, all the gutters flowed with beer, and the people stood beside the line to watch and wave and cheer. All the speeches that were made when the bosses smiled and said, the good times are just beginning, follow us and you'll go ahead. There's a light down the line, let it shine, shine, let it shine. There's a camp down the way. All the fettlers will be coming home today. Well, they built the streets so wide, it would be a thing of pride to walk across it drunk, or throw a stone to the other side. And the buildings grew so tall, you would tremble at the fall. But they just dried out and you'd never know there was anyone there at all. There's a light down the line, let it shine, shine, let it shine. There's a camp down the way. All the fettlers will be coming home today. I still hear the tall man say to the children at their play, you'd better go home early, and you'd better stay away from the line. Can't you hear the railway humming?
The grass has grown too tall, and the poison train is coming. There's a light down the line. Let it shine, shine, let it shine. There's a camp down the way. All the fettlers will be coming home today.
And that was Roy Bailey. Name of that song, The Poison Train. Again, you're tuned to Free Radio, 101.1 FM, Freak Radio. And we're going to go now to the streets. This is a tape from about a week ago, downtown on Pacific Avenue, actually just off Pacific Avenue on Cathcart, between Pacific and Cedar Streets, where I was went over to observe two police cars stopping another vehicle, as an African-American guy in a vehicle pulled over. And this is the conversation that ensued.
We're stopped here with two squad cars who've stopped a person of color in a vehicle right next to the Taqueria Vallarta. An individual's tried to talk to the individual in the car and has been prevented from doing so by Officer Hernandez. Step aside. No, I'm on the public sidewalk. I'm walking back and forth on the public sidewalk. If you don't like it, you may arrest me. So, we have a squad car here with a spotlight shined on another vehicle. This has been taking so far about 10 minutes as these two cars and two officers are stopping a man of color in a vehicle. Would you like to care to say, officer, why you're stopping this person? Sorry, Sergeant Harms? All righty then. So Sergeant Harms is preparing some kind of a report or perhaps a citation. And another officer is inappropriately directing citizens away from the scene. I hope that doesn't continue, and I hope Officer Hernandez is told what his appropriate function is in this situation, not to harass citizens, but to facilitate the situation. Nice t-shirt. That's a peace and love t-shirt passing by. So what we have too much of in Santa Cruz is the police state mentality, where individuals are directed away from scenes that they have the appropriate right to be near. Here we have an example of it. Two squad cars for one guy in a vehicle. It's not clear why we need two police officers for one stop here. One of them taking up two parking spaces, actually not even legally parked. They're in the bike lane here. Not blocking traffic, but certainly using up police resources. One of them is an unmarked car with three antennas on it. And both of them have flashing lights on the back of the car. It is 20-9 on August 21st, 2008. And I'm observing the scene, kind of partially in front of Taqueria Vallarta. It looks like the black car, we actually have three cars parked, one after another. The black car, which I kind of presume belongs to Sergeant Harms, but maybe not. Maybe it belongs to Officer Hernandez. It has a large, fancy computer in the front seat. I'm standing next to it looking through the passenger side window. And it's a completely black vehicle and has a license plate, CA exempt, and then 1284535, not that that means a lot. Similarly, the normal police squad car also has a license plate, which is CA exempt. The officers are returning to the vehicle, as am I. It's not clear why a second officer is necessary for a routine traffic stop. And Sergeant Harms is informing the individual in the vehicle. a something. I'm not quite sure what. Oh, for...
They caught him rolling a joint while he was driving.
Oh, is that what it was? Rolling a joint while driving. That is a person of color, right?
Right.
That is a black guy, right?
There's a black guy.
Yeah, I want to make sure that... Yeah. And the individual driver who's getting the citation is signing the citation, which is a promise to appear. Have a good night, Officer Hernandez. So,
I'd just like to explain one thing.
Sure.
It's really not a safe thing to...
And this is Sergeant Harms talking to me afterward. Again, at this point, all three cars are still parked, one after another, illegally parked, although, of course, police ignore these laws. They pulled this car over right there, actually, they're all in the bike lane where there's no parking by the side of Taqueria Vallarta. We aren't talking about any kind of serious crime actually happening. We're talking about what looks like a routine traffic stop, which Sergeant Harms discusses in more detail, though also with considerable more alarm, as you'll hear.
No, and this is one of the most dangerous things that we do,
mm-hmm.
is a car stop. We can't dictate where that person stops.
Mm-hmm.
This guy happens to be on parole for violent felonies, and
yeah.
you're walking up to a car. This man walking up to a car is jeopardizing his safety, and it's jeopardizing my safety.
Mm-hmm.
Do you understand? That's the reason Officer Hernandez did the absolute
But he wasn't
right
being stopped for a violent felony, was he?
Does it make a difference?
Sure. There are people who are on parole for violent felonies that are on Pacific Avenue, and I don't feel jeopardized.
And they assault police, and they assault people.
But he didn't assault you, did he?
You know what? I'm not going to allow that to happen, and that's why we have to be very controlling in a situation like this.
Well, you would be controlling. I'm afraid Officer Hernandez would be controlling regardless whether it was a violent felony or an ordinary stop.
Well, I'm not going to speak on hypothetical things. I'm speaking about this.
But I appreciate
right
your candor.
He absolutely did the right thing this time. And I'd appreciate it if he gives you a direction that you'd follow it, because you jeopardized our safety right there.
I see that you're well and healthy, and I'm glad that your safety was apparently not jeopardized.
Had he come out of his car, guns would have come out.
You know,
you getting up at that car, you jeopardize your own safety.
Every,
you should understand.
Considering
that.
The worst possible scenario is, I understand, a consideration you have to do, but it's not what ordinarily citizens are hoping for from the police department. I think you have to be prepared for that. But to treat everything as though it were the worst scenario,
like
I think, is the wrong way to
so
go.
I don't have to worry about you getting shot or being injured or having to take my attention away from what I need to be focusing on to pay attention to you.
My safety, though, isn't my responsibility.
It's my responsibility.
I mean, it is your responsibility. It's my responsibility, not yours.
It's mine.
No. No, I mean, not if it involves restricting my behavior. I mean, I make that choice. I can
you
say...
You make that choice.
Right.
But you're jeopardizing my safety.
I don't think by talking to the individual, I was jeopardizing your safety.
You'll never understand what I'm talking about.
Well, I might. But, I mean,
you've never been put in that situation.
Well,
I had to fight with people in cars when they charged me.
Right.
I've been there. And I don't want to have to deal with you with your microphone in my face while I'm wrestling.
No,
with
it's not in your face. It's at least 3 feet away from...
Should be pointed out, with all these alarmed comments by Sergeant Harms, the object of his concern, the potential shooter, a felony stop guy, or the guy who was on felony probation, was still in his vehicle, still sitting in the car, probably waiting for these two police cars to leave before he drove off himself, maybe fearful of getting a ticket, who knows what his motivation was. He was just sitting there waiting. And Sergeant Harms apparently didn't feel there was a threat to get into this lengthy discussion and dialogue with me about it. I was actually kind of trying to leave the scene because Harms had kind of made what he felt was his point. I don't agree with him on that. I think that the excuse that there's a terrorist threat at every turn of the wheel, at every time you go around a corner, is a very convenient way of, it's a mistaken way of viewing the situation, and it amasses an incredible amount of power for some politicians for police departments and the military throughout the world and particularly in the United States. So I didn't buy it. In theory, somebody can pull out a gun at any time, and that can become the excuse for the police saying you can't be here, you have to be far away from this because we want to protect you. Well, there was no indication the guy had a gun. There was no indication that there was any danger other than the fact that he was on felony probation. And since a lot of felonies, well, he said a violent felony, so I don't know what the details were, but since a lot of this is often connected with drugs, that is to say, people are falsely imprisoned for many years because of their use, sales, cultivation, or possession of drugs that the government considers illegal, it's really hard to have a lot of respect either for what's the status of these people as criminals, to consider that they're somehow dangerous because of that, or for the police departments that so go along with this massive charade, this massive waste of money, and this massive assault on common sense and on the Constitution.
That's right. Okay, let's be honest about that, all right? I'm not trying to intimidate you.
You're not intimidating me. I'm
good.
Not the least bit intimidated
good.
By
good.
You.
Good.
However,
well, I don't have a gun on me either, so, I mean, and you do. So,
right.
But
so
frankly,
it's not safe
to
approach violent felons without a weapon.
Or violent police officers.
And stick a microphone in his face either.
I didn't.
That could provoke a
violent felon. I didn't provoke
him. I'm not saying that you did.
The first thing I said to him was,
are
I said,
okay?
Are you okay? And he said yes. And he said yes. And that was fine. And then I got some more information from this man, and I decided to ask him another question. And actually, I didn't ask him anything. I walked up, and Officer Hernandez told me to get away, keep moving. And I said, no. I mean, I understand that Officer Hernandez may be trained in that way, and I understand you have your own sense of it.
And
we have a right to watch what is going on.
You're interfering and obstructing in what we're trying to do. We're conducting business here. Obvious police business. I've got lights on. I've got a police uniform.
That's correct.
And I gave you an order to get away from a car, and you don't do it, you can be arrested.
It depends on whether if it's a lawful order, that's correct.
It was absolutely lawful.
Well, that's the question. I didn't feel in this situation you were in any
You don't
danger.
Have to listen to the police?
No,
you
always...
Even if it's unlawful, you still got to listen.
Yes, but citizens should not obey unlawful orders, and from police officers, not healthy
but
to do that.
But this one was lawful.
Well, I think it was more a reaction, and I'm glad that we were able to work it out without any more difficulty.
I don't think we worked it out. I still think you would put yourself in the same situation.
I will come up to police cars stopping other cars, and I will observe what happens in such a way. Not
absolutely.
So
it's not a problem with you observing anything that we do.
Well, that's right.
But do it on our terms, please. Stay in a position of safety. If you want to come and stand, you know, on the sidewalk by my.
I don't think I was in a position of insecurity. I disagree with you, and I don't think you felt that way either, or you would have made more actions because I essentially ignored Officer Hernandez, and you did nothing to deal with that.
Because I was trying to finish this. To be honest,
and because you were aware there was not a safety.
I fully intended to do a parole search on this man, but I'm not going to do that right now because I figured you were going to cause a bigger disturbance for me, and you would have put me in a situation.
If you
where
want
I would
to do a parole search on this person, I'm not going to stop you. Why can't you? You can still do a parole search.
I don't know why he hasn't left. To be honest with you,
I don't know. Maybe he wants to chat with you. I don't know. But in any case,
feel free. You're more
but I don't want you to blame
him.
Me for not, you know, if you're not doing a parole search.
I'm not blaming you. I'm just telling you.
He just made the comment. But it
I
appears
just made
here.
A comment.
And first, as usual, Sergeant, you're candid as ever. I appreciate this. And I think maybe you're not educating me, but you're educating the people who hear this. So maybe that will satisfy you. That'll get out to the community.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'd be very excited if the community that listens to this understood that when the police have
I think
their
a lot of people will be sympathetic with you.
And they're dealing with something. It could be a potentially violent situation. You have no idea. Maybe this guy just robbed a bank. Hypothetically speaking.
I know.
He may have just murdered somebody.
But
he
I
may
don't
have a dead body in his truck.
That's correct.
Do you think it's a safe thing to go walk up on that?
However, what is not said on the other side of the equation is maybe the police are having a slow night and they're engaging in a number of harassment stops without probable cause or reasonable suspicion, as often seems to be the case on Pacific Avenue, or selective enforcement stuff. And that, of course, is what my concern is. That issue is not really enter into the equation that Sergeant Harms is talking about, at least from his side. But, of course, it's there, and it's the reason I'm there observing and talking to him about it and asking the man in the car if everything's okay. To treat everything as though it's the potential Lindbergh kidnapping may go well for police dramas on TV, and may give the police maybe what they're doing, but I don't think it's appropriate or right, particularly not in Santa Cruz. I think, in fact, it's part of the problem.
Do cop watches is because the great majority of cases do not involve that.
Then watch and don't get involved. How about that?
Well, sometimes when you ask the person, is everything okay, and you may consider that getting involved, but I don't.
I consider that absolutely getting involved, and you're distracting me from what I need to be focused on. that's going to provoke the police to maybe be a little bit more aggressive or assertive with you. And you need to expect that when you insert yourself in police action.
Well, and I think the police in routine stops
to watch and observe.
Yeah.
You start engaging the person that I'm dealing with, that's a whole different story.
I also have a right to ask questions of the suspect, provided it doesn't jeopardize you.
Exactly.
And provided it doesn't interfere. When you guys were doing nothing up here except conferring, and I asked him a question, that didn't jeopardize you. And I think it's inappropriate and misleading to suggest it did.
No, it's absolutely not misleading. In no way.
You have two police officers here.
Does he have a gun? Answer me that.
I haven't checked.
Exactly.
You think he's
so I have to assume that he does, because that's what I do with everybody. And if I don't, that's the time I'm going to get killed.
I have a gun?
I've known you long enough. I don't know this guy.
Now, if he had a real suspicion that the guy had a gun, in fact, even without a suspicion, he could have asked the man to step out of the car. Of course, he would have been making a bigger and higher profile stop. But if there were some justification for it, perhaps it would have been worthwhile. But My sense is that there wasn't justification for it. In fact, that Sergeant Harms was a backup for Officer Hernandez, who probably made a random stop. I was never actually told what the original reason for stopping this vehicle was. We never found that out, either from the individual in the vehicle or from either of these officers. So you're hearing, again, a lot of heightened rhetoric from the police, from Sergeant Harms, which I think, while it may be true in some situations, it certainly isn't true in most situations, I think, that the police engage in routine traffic stops on. And it's because it isn't true, it gives the misimpression that the citizenry should remain passive and quiescent and ever obedient to police officers' instructions, whatever they happen to be, for their own safety, which is wrong. It's wrong to surrender your judgment. It's wrong to surrender your solidarity with the rest of the community, because the police department has made some sort of judgment, particularly when you have a class-biased, selectively enforcing police department downtown, which is, I think, wasting a lot of resources and essentially engaging in a lot of institutionalized injustice.
So, almost everybody. People you don't know is what you're saying. No, I'm sorry, no coughing on Pacific Avenue. We're off Pacific Avenue.
We're off Pacific Avenue. Right. I can choke to death.
Street, come on.
I'm trying to get it together, Sergeant, but I'm feeling a little you've distracted me again.
Pretty light.
Yeah. I see what happens? How easy is it to have a conversation with me when you're trying to deal with me and he's over here chapping away?
I think you're interfering with a non-officer.
Exactly, and you're not even involved in something and you can't pay attention. I'm very much focused on this and you're interjecting yourself in my situation.
I need to go get coffee.
Don't do that anymore.
I can't guarantee my future behavior. I understand. If you decide you want to cite me, then you can take it to court and we'll see what happens. But I don't think I was interfering with you, and I appreciate your candor on this issue.
I really do. Okay.
We disagree.
Have a pleasant evening.
You too.
You know what? We can disagree all you want, but you'll be the one that goes to jail.
I take that as a threat.
I'm just saying, you put yourself in a situation that I don't feel safe, you will be arrested.
Then it has to be, I think, individuals objectively looking at it will then have to see that that is the case.
Someone in my position looking at it. Not a citizen, not anybody else. Somebody in my position.
Well, your subjective view is not simply the only criterion, I think. It has to be reasonable.
A like officer in a like situation. That's it. That's what I'm judged by.
But it has to be objectively reasonable, too.
Exactly. And every cop in the nation would say it's reasonable for me to tell you to get away from that car.
But what a jury say it's reasonable. That might be our protection. Because while the police may have heightened powers to act and restrain people from any kind of communication with someone they're stopping, even if they're engaged in massive harassment of that person, even if it's important to, frankly, for the peace of the community to have some kind of communication with the person to find out what's going on, even if you're not interfering with the officer by an objective criterion, what Sergeant Harms is saying here, as long as he feels that's the case, and if another police officer would agree with him that that's an objectively reasonable thing for him to feel, then the opinions of other people don't matter, which to me, of course, shows the elitist kind of standards that the police department uses, and not only uses, but he's suggesting, and perhaps properly so, perhaps accurately so, I should say, not properly, but accurately,
is what the law allows. It may well be. Although, we'll see if Donna Dice, whose arm was broken by Sergeant Christian Lamas back in May, and who is charged now with resisting arrest for no other charge, with no other charge appended to that, whether the jury of her peers, although she doesn't probably have any homeless people on the jury, no people living in an RV, I don't know if there'll be any disabled women of 60 years old or older on the jury. Those would be her peers, of course, but they're not necessarily going to be on the jury. I don't think it's going to go to a jury. I think they're going to drop this case simply because Sergeant Lamas fucked up, and the police department, rather than honestly and acknowledge it at an early stage of the game, they're doing their usual cover-up because they, as Captain Clark put it when he was a sergeant, when he stole blankets from the homeless as evidence that they violated the blanket ban, although he didn't need to, he could have taken photos. Why are you taking those blankets? Because we can. And it sounds like Sergeant Harms is saying the same thing. If he just feels like it's interfering with his routine police procedure to, you know, have to cordon off the area, in essence, because somebody might have a gun, because the person is, you know, maybe it's a felony probation stop or something, even though we've been sitting there for 5 or 10 minutes and the police, you know, and the police are still there and the guy is still there. He isn't being arrested. He's just sitting there. Anyway. Continuing with this, the final conclusion of this interaction on the street, which hopefully you can see the police perspective on. That's the reason I've recorded it. And also, I think, frankly, it's an example of the importance of questioning what goes on. Again, the whole conversation to me shows that there's no threat, no real threat, or else Sergeant Harm's judgment is very bad. And I don't think his judgment is bad. I think his judgment is pretty good. He views that he can have a conversation like this with me, a somewhat heated conversation, which would be very distracting. If there were a real issue, you know, with any kind of safety, the guy is there as he always was. He hasn't moved from the spot. He could have, you know, a sawed-off shotgun in his car. But still, Sergeant Harms is talking with me this way. So his story falls on its face because of the circumstances, the very reality of what's going on as he talks to me. It's just rhetoric that is being used to frighten people, plus the fact that the police have power. Power, guns, rhetoric, and money, and the shiny uniforms put us in a position of subservience. Well, time to get out of the position of subservience, folks.
And if they don't, they're foolish, and that's probably
and
the one.
Actually, though, what was said was not get away from the car. I was near his car. I wasn't near the other.
Getting near us and interfering between us and the target we kept.
No, I was near Officer Hernandez walking by, and I was talking into the tape recorder, as you heard me at the very beginning of this tape. So I wasn't, you know, my safety was not in question. It sounded like Officer Hernandez was making an arbitrary kind of comment, which kind of set me off, which was keep moving, which is not appropriate to say to a citizen on the street under those circumstances, I don't think. And I responded to it. Obviously, opinions will differ. They had a different opinion, and they're expressing that.
Could be a problem as well.
And I didn't do that. And I didn't.
And you walked back toward him. Absolutely.
I walked back on the public sidewalk, using the public sidewalk.
Directly back.
To treat this as a crime scene when it's a stop, to me, is a kind of a, frankly. And I don't mean to use labels. It sounds kind of fascist. I mean, you are elevating and escalating a situation when you do this.
No, I just have to be prepared for it.
Being prepared for it is one thing. Threatening me as a cop watcher is another. And I don't appreciate it. Sure. Next time you do this, you may be arrested.
That's a maybe. That's not a threat.
Let's hear what the audience thinks. They can call in and see if they think it's a threat or not. But maybe it is. I mean, I don't know. I mean, it's nothing personal, you know. I just
want you to be aware.
You're using your official position, and it. I don't think it's appropriate to do that the way you're doing it. I think to express your opinion is one thing. To state you may be arrested when you're standing with a badge and a gun and a uniform, another officer present, and two police cars is different. And I think
well,
you should
still standing here because it's not necessarily a safe situation still. Because as you know, this man is still here, so he's
doesn't,
watching.
Doesn't he have a right to park here?
No, he doesn't. See, it says no parking right there.
Oh well, maybe you should advise him. He should move.
I will.
But I don't think he's. You know.
It's unsafe for that particular reason. He may be violating a law, but to say it's unsafe. And, I mean, you may have information on it. Maybe you're stopping him for some great criminal investigation.
You never know.
But I take it that's not the case, or you would have referred to it at least obliquely, and you haven't. So this is a traffic stop, right?
This is a traffic stop.
Right. So, therefore, I think what I said initially goes. I think you should be looser and more considerate of the public in these traffic stops and not pull up these public safety considerations when they're not really relevant. That's all.
I will never know when it's relevant or not.
And
I can show you video after video.
You can't treat everybody like a criminal in that way, I don't think, and still maintain that.
I'm not treating anybody like a criminal. I'm trying to protect you and myself, and I think that's reasonable. Anything I do to protect me and you is reasonable.
It depends on how much behavior you're trying to control.
He didn't point a gun at you. He didn't order you to the ground. He told you to keep moving because it's in your best interest. He was trying to tell you a safe thing to do.
Yeah, however, you are indicating that this is something you would back up with force and with a threat of court action.
It could happen. Correct.
In another situation, I think I might have behaved differently. But in this situation, I felt it was an unreasonable thing to request.
Well, it's not up to you to decide.
It is always up to me, and it is always up to you to make a decision. We are, as human beings, we have to make these choices.
You're right. And so, you make a choice like that, you risk being arrested.
And I know I do. And I make that choice when I walk out on the street with a tape recorder.
And I don't.
It antagonizes police officers.
I don't believe you want to be.
Turn off that tape recorder, says a police officer. No, I say.
Have I ever asked you to
No, but the others on your force have. When I walk into your police station, they tell me to turn off the tape recorder. No, it's not. They're dealing with the public. Whatever little signs they put up, they're still dealing with the public. They have a responsibility, and we have the right to record them. They have the right not to say anything, but they damn well better conduct business, and they're not. And your higher-ups aren't doing anything about it, for that matter, and that distresses me. So I'm glad, again, I'm repeating myself. Listen, you have a good night, sir.
You too.
Take care. Officer Hernandez, take care.
Bye.
And that was that. I guess it was Friday or Saturday night on Cathcart near Pacific Avenue, around 8:45. Sergeant Harms has also asked me in the future not to tape record him without his permission. He did this in a previous encounter, and I told him I couldn't agree to that because part of my job was to pass on this kind of information to people on the radio and also, frankly, to make police aware that they are public officials and they're being publicly viewed in terms of what they're doing. And, you know, that may interfere with their sense of how they should proceed in a certain way, but they are entrusted with so much responsibility and they have so much force at their disposal that it is important that in order to be responsible, you need to have that kind of oversight. What do you think? Here's a caller. Perhaps I will get another opinion here. Hello, you're on Free Radio.
Yeah, same old. I want to talk about this issue.
Lloyd, it's you again.
Yeah, apparently I'm quite.
Are you
going to
be my perennial guest tonight?
No.
I guess so.
This officer treated you outrageously.
Why do you say that?
I heard the tape.
What was outrageous about his behavior? From his perspective, I was interfering.
This hyper-dramatic stuff that they do. All right, now I'll give you my take on it. Mm-hmm. I've seen the ads on television for the Monterey Police Department in Monterey County. They're very nice. They aren't wearing guns. They stand around in their uniforms and say, we're here to help the public and come on and join us. Now, look at the printed ad for the Sheriff's Department of Santa Cruz County in the Metro or the Good Times, whichever it is. Those guys look like they are posing with these guns. They look like they're soldiers in Iraq or something. Totally different ambiance.
So you felt that you call it hyper dramatic. I kind of think that tends to. I mean, you know, you and I, of course, we share probably a common concern about police misconduct and. Police violence at different points and police intimidation. So
I'll come out with a story right now. Mm-hmm. My major complaint against the police department.
Mm-hmm.
They murdered John Denae, a nice guy.
You mean John
Dine?
Go
around. Happy John.
Happy John Dine, yeah.
Yeah, well, John Dine. And he said, you know, he would say, hey, be happy, take acid. Well, whatever. I mean, you know, it's just a Guy on SSI. Let me tell the audience. He can say anything what he wants.
For those who are interested, there may still be the DA's report may still be in the library. I haven't checked lately. You might want to check.
DA's report, Lloyd. In the library. Well, I've got my report.
Well, wait a minute.
My report is
Lloyd. Hang on. I mean, the reason I mentioned it is because all the witnesses' accounts were a part of that.
No, I have another witness.
Wait a minute. All the witnesses or many of the witnesses' accounts were a part of that report, and actually they tend to show that Happy John had nothing in his hand, wasn't in a threatening posture. And he was, all the number of the statements made by then Police Chief Belcher and by District Attorney, then District Attorney Art Danner, were simply not supported by all the non-police witnesses, of whom there were about a dozen. And the only one who supported it was the shooting officer, Connor Carey's partner, Officer Over, and the bouncer for the bar of the Catalyst, who was at an active hostility to Happy John Dine and who was in the back of the car, and they were seeking him out. But, you know, that's an old case, and so that was 11 years ago. I don't have much to add to that,
Another witness.
Well, Lloyd, thank you. I want to hear more about that at another point, unless you got more you need to say, because I'm going to roll with a little more tape.
Great, and I wish somebody else would call in.
Me too. Thanks for calling in, Lloyd. All right, let's get back to the street interviews. You're tuned to Free Radio. 427-3772 is the number to call. Give me a call, and we'll put you on the air.
We're talking to that musician about town.
Yeah, Tamarack.
And Tamarack, you're dressed warmly for a warm evening.
Yeah, I was out at the beach.
How are you feeling?
All right.
How did the judge, or I should say Commissioner Bumkisser, no, what's her name, Basket?
She's okay. She's cool.
And what?
A pretty good lady. But anyways, I went to court.
Yes.
The guy didn't show up, and neither did the policeman. So they canceled it.
Case was dismissed.
Dismissed.
Very good. Congratulations, Tamarack. A brilliant victory on your part.
Right. Would you guys like some tomatoes? I have a...
I don't want tomatoes, but possibly she might. You might ask her.
Turn that off?
Yes. Repeat that for me, Tamarack.
Yes.
Here's a poem for her.
If you don't believe in their way, they're going to come looking for you night and day. They're going to make all of us pay really, really good to ride up on the freeway. Can anybody see how the landscape has all changed? Now, they got all your money. Yeah, they got all the money. And they still want more. And they broke in the store. Now, they're going to take everybody's money, and they're going to put it all in the dead game.
Thank you, Tamarack.
And what Tamarack was being cited and taken to court for was unreasonable noise before 10 o'clock because he was playing on his drum downtown, as he often does across from Borders Bookstore. And I've discussed at length how the unreasonable noise statute does allow performers to play. In fact, it protects them because it says if you're playing and your noise is involved with a legal activity, you really can't be cited for unreasonable noise, even if it's physically alarming or disturbing. I mean, that seems to be the wording of the ordinance, and hopefully we'll get attorneys like Kate Wells and perhaps Katya Komisarek, and who knows, maybe we can get some other people to sign on to argue the issue more cogently or to express it more clearly to protect street performers, because street performers, street musicians, face this situation where police come up and say, you know, you're going to have to move or it's not play anymore because somebody here doesn't like it. Well, the answer to that, as I said before, is, what do you think, officer? Is it too loud? No? Okay, well, then go back to the person, tell them that they can write me out a citizen's arrest if they want a complaint, but if they do, I will ask you to make I will swear out a complaint of a false police report, because, you know, this is before 10 o'clock, and there's essentially no way to show beyond a reasonable doubt that this unreasonable noise before 10 o'clock. There just isn't. You have to find some other way of dealing with it, which may mean that the city council has to change the statute. I actually don't know people who've taken an unreasonable noise before 10 o'clock ticket to court to find out where it goes, but the wording of the statute really makes it really hard to prove beyond a reasonable doubt, but police bluff you a lot, and musicians don't want to spend their time fighting in court or, you know, antagonizing the police. They want to just play music. Thank you very much.
Right now? Just 2 minutes. It's about 10 o'clock, and it's on, we're August 22nd, 2006.
It's under the boardwalk. Eight.
We're talking with Troy. Troy, you have a new puppet with you. This is a...
Knockout.
Got a knockout. The puppet just punched me in the nose. I resent that. But in any case, you were reminding me that you previously, things have gotten better for you because you...
I'm not scared.
And she's a little nervous, that puppet. You reminded me that you had not been, again, you said you were kicked.
I still have a headache from getting kicked by the cops.
Do you remember the cops who kicked you?
It's not important.
Long story.
I told my cousins and they're all Oakland.
I see. So
we will come here and deal with it.
Are you facing any charges as a consequence?
Why would I be facing charges? They kicked me.
Well, maybe you just weren't fast enough. Maybe
if it was filmed, I'd be a millionaire.
Again, we've been talking with...
I am going to set him up.
All right. Well, thank you, man. We'll call him the puppeteer. I just saw Ryan Coonerty passing by across the street here as I stand in front of Noah's New York Bagels, and it's about 11 o'clock on a Friday morning, overcast, but still mercifully cool. I'm talking with
Ralph Silvestri.
And Ralph, you're busy removing coupons from the Metro in order to get a better deal at Palace Arts Stationery. Have you seen anything on the streets lately, do you think, other than Mayor Coonerty walking by and ignoring my end, the sleeping van, that deserves notice or comment?
Yeah, you. I think you're a wonderful guy.
Oh, shucks. You say that to all the beard guys. Come on.
Anybody that's got a beard is wise like Moses and Jesus.
Well, I'll put that in my pipe and smoke it. Thank you. Nothing else?
That's all for right now. I'm not quite awake right now.
All right. It is a little early, although it's getting later. Aha! There he is, the bane of Barry Swinson. Now, what's the story, Don, in the La Bahia situation?
Well, it's a long story, Bob, as you know. It's not...
Summarize it for the idiots who are listening to the radio show.
No. I don't think idiots listen to the radio. I listen to the radio. What are you talking about?
We're all idiots in one sense or another, but you're quoted, of course, in today's Sentinel, about the La Bahia project. Yesterday there was a protest out there.
Oh, there was. And first I want to thank... Genevieve Bookwalter. I thought she did a great job. I'm glad she came out for it. It was good that the Sentinel covered it. I appreciate their covering it, frankly.
Mm-hmm.
There was a protest by a coalition of...
Sure. I'll see over to the side.
Yeah. It was I don't know that I'd call it a protest. It was a demonstration of sorts, and it attempted to be a thought-provoking demonstration of...
Involved balloons, right?
Yeah. Some of the fellas ordered some balloons, helium balloons, and tried to float them up to a level of 70 feet or thereabouts to indicate the height of the building. You know, we've been trying to get story poles now. It's coming up on a year, back September 2007.
Story poles are poles that would tell you where exactly how much would be blocked.
They're used in jurisdictions all over the place for a long time. They indicate the height and the placement, and that's all they indicate. They don't indicate what the style of the building is going to look like or where the windows
are. Poles are 70 feet.
Poles, and there were some, typically they're used on smaller places in all of those jurisdictions where they actually care about view corridors, and I mean, here we pay lip service to it, but there are jurisdictions where, you know, even a little building in a visual place for the public is offensive, and they say, well, we got a rule about that. Now, we don't do that, you know.
The history of La Bahia, of course, is, as Genevieve Bookwalter puts it, an aging... Is it Bookwalter or Bookwater? I'm not sure.
Bookwalter.
It's an aging project which used to be a lot of senior housing and has now, I guess, some students living there. It's near on the beach street near the boardwalk.
Yeah, it's an old building. It's built in 1926, and it's on the city landmark list as one of its, one of its premier landmarks. A lot of people don't like it at all. They think it's a decrepit old place that ought to be taken down, and the part of this current proposal is to do just that. It's been used for a variety of uses over the years. I think it was originally built as a long-term kind of luxury housing in conjunction with the original Casa del Rey, which is now gone, of course, and that was an overnight stay in the apartments, the Casa del Rey apartments.
Torn down after the earthquake in 1989.
Casa del Rey was, yeah. The La Bahia still stands, although its owners who have owned it now, well, Charles has owned it since 1985.
That's Charles Canfield.
That's right.
East Boardwalk. Mogul?
Well, the Seaside Corporation, the Seaside Company, operates a lot of beach assets down there, and They bought it in 85.
Great returns to the city in terms of tax benefits, right?
No doubt about it.
I'm being sarcastic. Do you think he actually does provide a lot of significant returns to the city, or do you think he costs the city more than he provides?
I don't know in what sense he costs the city more than he provides, but I know he provides a great deal of tax money, the parking revenue he brings in on a weekend is astounding, and the tax revenue he pays both in property taxes and to operate the boardwalk in the Coconut Grove.
Do you know how much that is? Or?
I don't, but it's...
many a critic has said that Canfield gets a lot of city services and actually produces a lot of trash and crime problems and traffic problems that aren't really paid for by his taxes, but I've never researched it myself, so I don't know.
Yeah, I don't share that view, and obviously there are city services that maintain the tourist business assets, but to me the tourist industry in this town is kind of like a relatively clean industry, and it's not perfect, but it's relatively clean, and it's a good way to go for this town if they really want to increase the tax base, which I think they have to do ultimately.
So La Bahia, a new big hotel there, what is it, 7 stories high they want?
Yeah, well, stories are like room counts, you know. I mean, one 7-story building is different than another, apparently, just like one 125-room hotel.
That would bring in tax revenue. Why are you opposing it, or why the protest?
I'm not opposing it. What I'm opposing is the size of it. I think a lot of the idea of building a hotel at the La Bahia. The La Bahia, I've said for 10 years now, is a great hotel lot. They ought to build a great hotel there and not just a great big one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was a nice quote from the paper, and I kind of like that. But I guess I take it you're not a fan of the attempt to reclaim the Tidewater parking lot property that some people have been pressing against Canfield.
Well, that's been a 10-year battle. That's at the river mouth of the parking lot. Is that what you're speaking
of? The Tidelands,
yeah. Okay. I can recall looking at it briefly 10 years ago when it began as a struggle, and I really can't say enough about it knowledgeably to have an opinion as to whether it's what the legal position is. I think it ultimately turns out to be a legal question, and whether or not the city can have taken enough steps in the interim to solve all of their legal problems, which is likely what they would have tried to do, I don't really know. I really haven't followed
it. For those who don't know, this is the parking lot of which Canfield's parking lot near the Big Dipper stands is a contested piece of property, at least in the minds of some. Phil Baer and other activists brought the issue forward in the late 90s, claiming that Canfield had been making a lot of money off this property, essentially illegally, that it belonged to the city and that the city should sue, and the city started to sue, and I'm not sure what's happened to the lawsuit. But the reason I bring it up here is because there are some who either are opposed to that, more sympathetic, let's say, to Canfield in some respects and his position on this issue, and then there are those who are in favor of the city's getting this property back. But there seems to be kind of a coalition of people who are, and then there are some who don't really know or have a lot of information on it. But a number of groups have come together to oppose the current Swenson drive to get a kind of a plan rubber stamp by the city council on September
23rd
at their second council meeting. Or is it a council meeting?
It is a council meeting. The commissions have already met and issued their recommendations. And I don't know that I would characterize the city council at this point as a rubber stamp. It may be that the promoters of this thing have seen it that way over time. They may have thought that they had the politicians, if not in their pocket, at least over a barrel. But I think that there are a majority of city council people who will have open minds. Frankly,
we were at the SEIU debate or candidate forum, I believe, in mid-August. Actually, it's August now. A couple weeks ago.
Yeah,
it's a couple weeks.
Yeah,
but and you heard the candidates, at least 6 of them. I've talked to 2 who claimed they weren't even invited, in spite of what Bonnie Moore claimed at the forum, that all were approached and invited. And there are 10 candidates running, and only 6 were available. The 5 of them, of course, were former city council members or present city council members who are running for re-election or are running for election.
What's your sense of the field of candidates on this particular issue? Did you learn anything new at the forum? Do you have anything to say about if you were voting simply on the basis of the La Bahia issue, which candidates you'd be most sympathetic to simply on that basis?
Well, I haven't looked at all the candidates yet. I appreciated all the candidates that showed up. I don't know anything about their not having been invited. It's always difficult to know in a large field whether or not to invite everyone or whether only to invite the ones you think have a reasonable chance of succeeding. And
witness
four
the Bush the Bush Obama discussion, excluding the minor party candidates who actually are actually discussing the real issues.
Yeah, or even Ralph Nader for that matter.
Right.
Has been a debate
or Cynthia
for years.
McKinney or Bob Barr.
Right. Yeah, well, it's always a problem. It really is. I wouldn't vote on only on the La Bahia issue, and I don't think I would tell you at this point exactly who I'd vote for, even if I knew. I didn't learn anything new about the candidate's position at the La Bahia. You hardly ever learn anything new about a candidate's position in a forum, Robert, because it's
a bunch of sound
heavily
bites.
Cliched, and it's tailored to achieve an endorsement from a group, and the labor group's an important one. I think that they boosted Don Lane up the channel. I don't know. There's four seats available. There's, as you point out, five experienced candidates and a sixth one, David, who showed up at that forum, who's obviously
Reese's.
Serious. Mm-hmm. And for four seats, it's unlikely that he'll attain one of them, but still, it's a possibility. And
what about Craig Canada, the marijuana candidate?
Pardon me, I don't know.
He's a formerly homeless guy who's running for
What's
city council. Craig Canada, J. Craig Canada, actually.
Canada,
as in the country.
Canada. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah,
good.
Just wondering. I mentioned him because he actually called my show yesterday and gave his position not on La Bahia or any of the issues we're talking about, but on issues nearer and dearer to my heart, like civil rights for people in public spaces and process. That city council would actually allow people to have public comment on these issues. So that issue did come up at the SEIU, and I didn't bring it up, actually. Somebody else did.
I didn't either. But, yeah, no, that issue, in the several councils I've been invited to talk to the candidates, it has come up repeatedly, frankly.
Now, have there been other issues other than the other forums other than the SEIU one?
No, I don't mean forums in that sense. I don't know that there have been or not. Yeah. I know there's always a bunch coming up in campaign season. Well, no, I mean in, private meetings with people who talk about
politics. You've actually talked to candidates privately about this issue.
Well, about I've heard it discussed. I don't get involved in it, but I do recognize it as an issue that's being talked about. I think largely because Ryan Coonerty, in an effort to speed meetings along and administer his role as mayor a little more efficiently, in his view, has limited. Or at least he's done things that make it appear as though he's severely limited people's access to the government. And frankly, you know, there's very few avenues for people to address the issues that the city council faces on our behalf. There are those meetings. And, you know, you're typically given a minute or two. To
or less.
Yeah, I know. If you're allowed to speak at all,
right?
And in your case, I know that's a problem. But even 2 minutes, you know, for those of us with the luxury of 2 minutes, it's still
it's not very long compared to the staff's lengthy presentation
of the season of the 4-year cycle when you actually get to
lambaste them.
Well, I don't lambaste them, and which gets me back to that question you asked originally about did I learn anything about their positions on the La Bahia, or what are their positions, or who would you vote for, that kind of thing. I tend not to, for as much as I interact with the powers that be, I tend not to press them to agree with me too much. I don't really expect politicians to say, I'm with you on that one all the way. I really don't like it. I much prefer, even if they disagree with me, that they keep an open mind until they actually have enough information to make a good decision.
It was interesting that of all the candidates other than Ryan Coonerty on the issue of Coonerty's cutting back of time on the consent agenda, massively cutting back time so that now people can speak for only without the they need now the permission of the city council to speak. They need a council member to pull an item off the consent agenda in order to talk about it, whereas in every other city throughout the state, with the possible exception of Berkeley, which is revising its views on this, anybody who's a member of the public can demand that there be at least a brief period of discussion on a consent agenda item. And, of course, these are items that make up more than half the agenda in the afternoon and often concern items that the city council thinks are rote and routine, but the members of the public also often recognize involve huge amounts of money, and they involve issues that may be important to examine more closely. And I noticed all the council, the consent agenda as an issue did not come up at the SEIU forum.
Right.
But the issue of shortened city council meetings when the council, everything is crammed onto the afternoon agenda, and this has happened at least three or four times in the last 6 months, where public comment time during the oral communications period where you can talk about items that aren't on the agenda, has been reduced to 2 minutes per person and split. Actually, I kind of like that, between 3 o'clock and 7 o'clock. It gives people more options. I commended Coonerty for that, one of my rare positive comments about our mayor.
Attaboy, Robert.
Hey, I'm trying to be, you know, be fair after all, right? But, in fact, every single member of this body said, except for Catherine Byers, who wasn't there, of this body of, on the candidate forum, that they felt there need to be more rather than less public comment, and inferentially, if not directly, criticized Coonerty for cutting back time, allegedly to streamline meetings.
Yeah. Well, you know, if he got up in the morning and said, "I'm really going to take away some human rights today," I'd be on your side with that one. But I don't think that's what happened. I think he really is trying to streamline it, and whether or not that was a good way to do it, time will tell. Like I say, a lot of people are talking about it as an issue, not specifically with reference to the consent agenda, but the idea that somehow public access is being limited. I'll tell you honestly, on the other side of the coin, I've, as I say, attended the commission, Historic Preservation Commission meeting, and the Planning Commission meeting, several of them that have taken place over the course of the last couple of years, about the Lubbahia. And the PowerPoint presentations, the deadly, fatal PowerPoint presentations you have to sit through to finally get to the point where you get to talk at
that's
a public.
That's not the public, that's the staff.
I realize, yeah. But and the developer and the our consultant and the whole bunch of people. When you finally get to talk, you get your 2 minutes, and the important decisions that the commissioners, you know, public-spirited citizens all are struggling with. They finally make up their mind about important policy matters somewhere around midnight on in the middle of the week when everybody's tired and the public has talked to them for 2 minutes. You know, it seems to me there really does need to be some better way.
Well, Lane proposed, I think, you know, the traditional manner is to hold a meeting the next day or in several days down the road to continue the issue if there's sufficient public interest. And Coonerty has never done that.
One of the obvious ways, the other one is to somehow make it all move faster. And
that's what staff less time, you know. I mean, it seems to me, I mean, Coonerty's claimed, and perhaps properly and accurately so, that he's tried to, you know, encourage the staff to shut it down more quickly. But, you know, one obvious thing is to put time limits on council speech, as they do in the national legislature. The council members have a certain amount of time to speak, and that's it. And then they have to move on, you know, I mean, unless they're granted more time by the chair. But, of course, you know, that would cut into the precious prerogatives of Mike Rodkin, and I don't think that could ever be the case with Big Mike on the council, although who knows, maybe, I can't really say, I haven't asked him on that issue. Anyway, we've been talking with
Don Weber.
Don, you are a sometime city council candidate, but not this time.
Oh, not this time. No, my political career lasted about 40 days, Robert.
40 days and
like,
probably 40,
eight,
40 nights.
40 nights.
Yes.
It's good to see you,
thanks,
sir.
Thanks, Don.
And that was a lengthy interview with Don Weber, who is usually considered pretty much to the right of center, but often people who are out of power kind of packed together on the right and the left because they recognize that they're treated with equal disdain by the city council, and they also are denied access to sort of the basic right to speak to the community and to the council and for the council to be open about what it does. And that's something that both people on the right and on the left can be concerned about. You've been listening to Bathrop Spear's Broadsides. We've rolled into Uncle Dennis's time. Uncle Dennis does his show from the cream to the dregs, usually from 8 to 11. It's looks like he's a little, maybe he's been delayed on the road, possibly maybe there's some highway robbery going on. Maybe he's stopped off to get a couple beers. He usually comes in hoisting a few. In fact, there are some beer bottles from his earlier benders here in the studio, so perhaps we can... He can discuss the delights of this beer or that. I think he does, in fact, on his show, as well as providing updates, environmental updates, Earth First updates, and so forth. So that's what you listeners who've patiently sat through my show or perhaps just tuned in have in store for you when Uncle Dennis comes rolling down the road. I'm going to play a little music now from another selection from Roy Bailey, and hopefully we will get some... news as to what Uncle Dennis is planning to do, or possibly he'll simply arrive and do it.
I come from the mountain, Kentucky's my home, where the wild deer and the black bear so lately did roam. By the clear rushing waterfall, the wildflowers dream. Through every green valley there runs a clear stream. Now there's scenes of destruction on every hand, and there's only black waters run down through my land. Sad scenes of destruction on every hand. Black waters run down through my land. Now the quail, she's a pretty bird, she sings a sweet song. In the roofs of the tall timber, she nests with her young. Now the hillsides explode with the dynamite's roar, and the voice of them small birds will sound there no more. And the hillside comes sliding so awful and grand, and the flooding black waters run down through my land. Sad scenes of destruction on every hand. Black waters run down through my land. In the rising of the springtime we planted our corn. In the ebbing of the springtime we buried our sun. In the summer comes a nice man, says everything's fine. My employer just requires a way to his mine. Then they tore down the mountain and they covered my corn. And the grave on the hillside's a mile deeper down. And the man sits and talks with his head in his hands. And the poisonous waters flow over my land. Sad scenes of destruction on every hand. Black waters run down through my land. Well, I ain't got money, not much of a home. I own my own land, but my land's not my own. If I had 10 million somewhere thereabouts, I'd buy Perry County and I'd run them all out. And I'd sit on the bank with my bait and my can, and watch the clear waters run down through my land. Now wouldn't that be like the old promised land? Black waters, no more on my land. Sad scenes of destruction on every hand.
black waters run down through my land. Dinner's done, it's time to clear the kitchen table. Rubber soles and leather uppers stacked in rows. Ali's on the needle, Mohammed spreads the glue. Mother does the dishes, Dad's drunk and wants to argue. Fatima's hands are bleeding, tonight she gets to watch a TV show. In the morning she'll have twice as much to do. So lie down and sleep, little one. There's only 4 hours till dawn. Tomorrow's a new day. The deadline's on Tuesday. There's still so much work to be done. Now Mohammed, he won't speak to his dad no more. Says he had a nerve to bring them here. Fatima, she's older, she's got a bit more sense. She knows her old man's drinking is just his last defense. Her mother looks so weary. Ali pours his dad another beer. He drinks it down with a broken man's defiance. He says, lie down and sleep, little one. There's only 4 hours till dawn. Tomorrow's a new day. The deadline's on Tuesday. There's still so much work to be done. Fatima remembers the sliver of light under the door in the night. Dad's off to work, snuggle up tight. He's taking us all to Australia. In the Melbourne dawn, a little girl climbs out of bed. No school today, she'll work for 16 hours. On Sundays, she wanders through the malls and the arcades. In clothes she feels ashamed of, sees all the pretty things she's made. Fatima, your hands are bleeding. One day bleeding hands will seize the hour. Today she's just a child slave of the rag trade. So lie down and sleep, little one. There's only 4 hours till dawn. Tomorrow's a new day. The deadline's on Tuesday. There's still so much work to be done.
Thousands now are dead. It was Arab terrorists. This is what you said. Well, if that is the truth, then what have you got to hide? What were you doing on the day all those people died? Where the fuck were the fighter jets ordered by the FAA? What is your explanation for what you were heard to say when you told the Air Force to stand down? not to intercept? Did you plan to let it happen, or are you just inept? There's some distressing information, sir, which I think should be explained. Just which things have been lost, and just what has been gained. Like the thousands of put options bought days before the crash. If the money were collected, it'd make quite a pretty stash. And the only stocks they bought were American and United. Deutsche Bank knows the answer, but the names have not been cited. And is it just coincidence that this firm in the private sector was once run by Fuzzy Krongard, now CIA director? I am left to wonder, as the flames are rising higher, was this our latest Lusitania, or another Reichstag fire? There's something fishy in Virginia, and I want an explanation. Why did they get the contract? What is Britannia Aviation? A one-man operation, corporation with no history. He said he worked in Florida, but there he was a mystery. So is there a...